Accountants Are Sexy is back for another season, and this season we'll see our 100th episode. I want to take a moment to thank everyone that's helped so far. Every like, listen, subscribe, watch, all of it means the world to me. This season is sponsored by Charterpath. Charterpath is a charity designed to help the financial skills gap within nonprofits. I've recently joined their advisory board to help them on their mission to increase volunteering within the financial sector from only 10% to a very healthy 50%. If you want any more information on how you can be a part of this mission, then drop me a message or leave a comment or visit their website, charterpath.org. Now, are we ready to meet the guests? Hello and welcome back to another episode of Accountants Are Sexy, Change My Mind. Now, this dude sitting next to me is not an accountant, but he is sexy. Let me introduce him. He's an international leading, well, he's a global inspirational speaker. You probably have seen him if you've been to any of the accounting events. This chap is Nick Elston. Nick Elston, welcome.
Hello. This is the best build-up ever. I'm going to take you with me everywhere I go now. This is brilliant.
It's
despite the Iron Maiden t-shirt, I'm still a country music boy at heart. So for people that do know me, you'll know I'm a country. But I saw my dad today and he's an Iron Maiden fan, so I was paying homage to him.
Who's not an Iron Maiden fan? Is that a thing anymore?
I know.
I mean, especially since Stranger Things, right? Like, everyone is a Iron Maiden fan.
Absolutely. I went to see Iron Maiden. I know we got in a really weird rabbit hole right from the start, but went to see Iron Maiden last year with my dad in Birmingham, in the best concert ever.
I went to the O2 in London.
Did you? What a tour that was. Anyway.
Yeah, it was phenomenal. Reverse. Loved all the animatronic-y bits and all of the movement. Yeah. I love it.
So cool.
Right, enough about Iron Maiden.
Yes.
Because they actually do help. No, I'm going to go off on a tangent. I'll come back. We're here to talk about mental health. We're here to talk about mental health. You have been delivering speeches all over the globe about mental health challenges. And from going to these accounting events, I've seen how busy they can be. Okay, and how much choice you have for listening to different speakers that are talking about all kinds of subjects. And as I sat in your session, this was at Accountex North a couple of years ago, I couldn't believe the way that you held that room together. People were captivated. They didn't want to move. They needed the information that you were giving them. And it was at that point I thought, oh, I should probably speak to Nick and get him on the podcast. So it's been a long time coming, but I think it's such an important subject to talk about and it doesn't get talked about enough.
It is, not especially with accountants. Like you say, I'm not an accountant or anywhere close to it. I'm awful with both numbers and money. but there we go. That's probably me oversharing right from the start. But I think it's actually getting to the real core of it. I think very often, and what brought me into this space, were actually accountants have as much trust and rapport with their clients as their clients will do with their medical profession. We no longer have a familial relationship with a GP or the medical profession. Therefore, you that they trust with their money, their lifestyle, their livelihood, they're going to tell you everything. And some of that everything will be around how they're actually feeling. So the question that I would have asked on stage was, who looks after the people that looks after people? Yeah. And that's why it's really resonated so well in the accountancy space since I first did the first event in your space was at Accountex 2016 in London. And it was an amazing thing. It was the first time that the team at Diversified had tried a lived experience approach to this topic because I'm not solution focused, I'm not a coach or a counselor.
Yeah.
Wouldn't want that in your life, trust me. but it was the first time we tried it. And I was terrified, if I'm honest with you, I was terrified because I wasn't sure what the reaction was going to be. And what I found was that it was like standing room only, people were crawling through the window trying to get in. There was such a need to have an emotionally led conversation around this stuff. In a space which actually maybe it's not actively encouraged to have emotional conversations, or certainly wasn't back in the day, 8 years ago now. And that's where it really started. And I started doing a little bit of writing for XU and for Receipt Bank. And then I got asked back to do Accountex many times. And then I met you and all these lovely people that all the other speakers I've kind of got to know along the way as well. And I've never really left the space. And I think especially through the pandemic and through lockdown and everything else, I think accountants were pretty much considered frontline. They certainly were for me. My accountant was the speed dial 999 number a lot of the time.
Some of the stories that came out of the pandemic were crazy, like accountants from their phone to their clients at 12 o'clock at night trying to make sense of the updates that were coming through. The level of service was like phenomenal. And then there was those on the flip side of that who couldn't deliver that because they themselves were suffering.
Yeah.
Yet, and then they were being penalized or being spoken to by other accountants saying, well, you should be on the phone at 12 o'clock at night. And they're like some of the correct stories that came out were crazy. Poor accountants.
I know. You had Boris and Rishi do the latest press conference telling people what was available. And then their kind of clients were on the phone to them straight away. Okay, fix this for me. What? Yes. I just literally saw the same press conference as you. I do not know how to access this stuff.
We do not get advanced notice.
Yeah. And there was this really weird thing that happened. I saw this in accountancy more than any other space that I work in. That there's this weird thing that people were encouraged to do everything for free.
Yeah.
So we help people for free because it's a good thing to do. And
there's we help businesses make money for free.
Yeah, exactly. And there has to be an element of give back and that kind of stuff. But let's face it, the mortgage doesn't get paid on dreams and missions.
Mm.
That's what I checked anyway. I did check, but it doesn't. So
I've asked.
There seems to be everyone shamed into charging clients for things. I just thought it was a really weird space. And I think that's when I really did most of my stuff in a big way in the accountancy space was through that period.
Yeah. I think people, when they think about accountants, they think they've got it all together. You know, they've got to be good with money. They've got to be good with people. They've got to be good at business. They've got to be good at all of these things because they see accounting as the primary function of any business.
Yeah.
But to be an accounting business owner doesn't necessarily you're equipped with all of those skills like straight away. It's not like you've learned them or you just have come across them. You're probably highly skilled in accounting and like everybody else has to have to learn along the way. So there is a lot of pressure on their shoulders, I find. That like there is an expectation that they've got it all together, which must be really hard to kind of manage.
It is. And I know you'll get this, that it's very much the same as the frontline. So I do a lot of work with Ministry of Defence, with frontline military and those kind of environments. And it's obviously an environment you know well. And with that kind of space, it's knowing what to do isn't always good enough. And I always kind of throw back the question to audiences. I bet you've given people fantastic pieces of life advice recently. Did you take that advice yourself? And was the answer? We don't. Knowing what to do isn't always good enough. And I think it's really important to recognize that because there was a lot of guilt, misplaced responsibility. And also, it's like a twisted game of pass the parcel. That people were getting really anxious and really worked up about lack of income or that brown letter going through the letterbox and all the things that trigger. There's such a strong link between money and mental health, especially when you don't understand money. Or you have a fear around money, or your relationship is negative. So therefore, they have all these anxieties. They just pass on to the accountant, and then they walk away whistling. And your accountant says, okay, what have I got to do?
Like a little gift. Here you go. Have all of my stress, and I'm off now. Goodbye.
It's really, I'm not sure if we can swear on here, it's really messed up. It's just really genuinely messed up. And I think, is the equivalent of giving somebody like a big bag of receipts and just say, right, go for all that kind of stuff. Yeah. It's that kind of problem that, it's this transferal of anxiety. But that's not just a pandemic thing. That's especially what we're recording this just after the January kind of cold, especially this time of the year. There's so much of that. It's kind of twisted game of pass the parcel. And I think that's the reason why a lot of the work that I speak about around mental health in the accounting space is around boundary setting, actually.
Yes.
It's been communicating your boundaries to clients, to people. Because if you don't, It's actually, if you don't manage expectations of people, it just only increases stress.
Yeah, I think when I first realised about managing expectations, it's in a sales context. And if you manage the expectations, then they're not disappointed with you. If you're managing the expectations, then they are going to be repeat customers and they're going to come back and come back and come back. I learned that quite early on. I didn't realise that actually that knowledge wasn't common knowledge. But it's weird though, isn't it? What you learn early doors, you don't realize that other people hadn't learned. So it's to set the boundaries and expectations. This is something that comes up in conversation with my captains, like on a daily basis. And it's just communicate. And they say, well, I've chased and I've chased and I've chased. I'm like, well, How about setting the communication 3 months in advance instead of 3 months after it needs to happen?
Yeah.
You know, so it's just, yeah, communication is a massive thing and misunderstood.
But you can build boundaries into your processes as well. I mean, yeah, we run the risk of going down a real rabbit hole here. But if you look at, so somebody sends me an inquiry for me to speak at one of their events. So they tend to get a 3-page booking form. Not because I'm a diva, I promise. What I'm doing I'm setting my boundaries. What I'm doing is I'm managing everything that potentially could go wrong well in advance. I'm being very clear about payment terms, being very clear about what demographic, size of audience, type of audience, AV equipment. And in my space, that's my way of setting boundaries because I've been very clear, these are the terms that I need for you to engage with me on. And that's how we go forward. But very often we stumble into client relationships or kind of agreements with people, but actually knowing what the desired outcome is.
Because you think it's too rude to ask. Oh, I can't ask that. I can't do this. I can't do that. And it's, and if you just have an open, frank conversation in the first place, everyone's going to be happier.
It's very true. I coach people to share, I'm not presentation skills by any stretch. I leave that to other people. I coach people to share lived experience in a professional environment. So to tell emotionally led stories to people. Do you know what the biggest question is for people to go pro? It's not about stage skills. It's not about telling your story. That's definitely part of it. The biggest question is, how do I ask for money? Because the definition of professional speaker or anything is means you've been paid once. It's not a guarantee of quality. Professional means you've been paid once to do something. So actually, how do we have conversations around money? Actually, it's very simple. We ask a question. And if you're afraid about asking a question, having these kind of little sub-questions like, what's your budget? That's a really soft way of having open conversations. But it's very different in the UK. So the work that I do in the US and South Africa and Australia, for example, both all of those environments are very much right, bang, 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 this is it, this is it, this is it. And you can be very clear and open about money. But in the UK, we've got this really weird relationship with money. We don't ask people about stuff. And I guess going back to my childhood, we didn't ask like how much your uncle's new car was, or we don't talk about money. We don't talk. It's an amazing thing, really, isn't it?
You're speaking my language. I have had to learn about money.
Yeah.
Because in my house, even though my dad was, my stepdad is a financial advisor, and you know there is investments and there were all sorts of pensions going on and all sorts. It's not like we were short of money. We just weren't allowed to talk about it. So I remember once I was going down to see family down in Devon, and I was on, I must have been like 19 or about 19 years old, and I was on like 12 grand a year or something. I was like, well loaded. And I was going down to see my family in Devon, and my mum said, don't talk about how much money you get, that you earn. Like, they don't earn that. Because they're down in Devon, like they're not, like I was living in London. They didn't earn the same as me. And she made me feel very guilty and very shameful of the success that money. And there are stories all around that, that I've had to kind of unpick and unravel to be comfortable to have conversations and ask for money. And it's been a real journey.
It is a journey. And there certainly is a conditioning element. Like you said, you're growing up, your upbringing, family relationship with money. I know when somebody first asked, how much do I charge to come and speak? I was terrified. I didn't have a clue what to say. Finding your own way, and you make mistakes and you kind of find something you're happy with. Now I've got the confidence to keep on kind of pushing things up. And I think there's two things on that. I think the first thing is I got into this as a passion, as therapy, actually. And when I started to get paid for it, it took some of the shine away, if I'm honest with you, because it was so suddenly it was a job. It wasn't. So I had to create an ecosystem which ticked the ethical and moral boxes, but paid the bills.
Yeah.
So how I did that was I quite openly charged my corporate clients a lot of money. However, they subsidize the work that I do in the prison and education system. And collectively, that subsidizes the work that I do with domestic abuse charities and kind of young adults groups for free. So the whole ecosystem means that I can kind of justify to myself. But I think also it's our relationship with time and money. And somebody said to me yesterday, well, I've quoted this to go and speak somewhere for an hour, but now they only want 30 minutes. How much would you charge? It's exactly the same. They're not paying for your time. They're paying for your experience. They're paying for your profile, your visibility, your interaction, your engagement. So actually, do what I do, you charge the day. It's not an hour of my time, it's a day. If I do an hour of a stump day, either way, my day's gone.
I'm taking a day out of my time, my life, to come and deliver this. So it's a day's work. That's a really interesting way of looking at it. I've never considered it.
I think don't charge for time.
Yeah.
Which is difficult in your space. It's difficult to kind of come away from that way of thinking. But what they're paying for is your experience. They're paying for your specialism and your skill set. It's kind of like saying that there's an overnight success, or this rock band's an overnight success. It'd take 20 years to become
an overnight success. All the hard work. So let's go back. I want to talk, because we were talking about the apocalypse that was happening back in 2020. and all the stress that the accountants were going through, we've kind of moved into a new era. And we're moving into a new era where we're finding our feet more, things have changed, the landscape, the business landscape has changed, the demands of people have changed, their staff demands have changed, client demands have changed. Like, so we've moved into this era and we seem to be finding our feet now. But what kind of things are you seeing from this change? What's come off the back of it?
So there's a quote that I say at the end of every talk that I deliver is, every storm runs out of rain. And if you are a country music fan, it's a great track by Gary Allen as well, but there we go. But I was hoping to retire that line in January 2022. I thought, the pandemic's on the way out, the economy's on the way back. What could possibly go wrong in January 2022?
And now we're just bouncing our way through the recession.
Global conflict, 15 prime ministers, change of monarchy. So I'm still saying every storm runs out of rain. Excuse me. But I think there's something in that. I think it's about changing our relationship with change. Mm. And I think certainly that comes with experience. For me, it's come with age. I think, take it from an old guy looking back, that it's only been through the periods of chaos that the magic has happened. It's only been through the periods of adversity, as we are experiencing a lot of the time at the moment, that the most exciting things happen, but you never see it at the time. So I think it's changing our relationship with change. And in any given moment, trying to kind of figure out, what does this situation, what doors open from here? I think attitude is everything and opportunities are everywhere. And if we remember those two things, even in the worst situations, and as you know, on a personal level, it's been a very, very tough couple of months, but even in that period, there's things can happen from that, which is going to create good at some point. I can't see those now, but at some point that potentially could happen. And I think when we start to see it like that, and therein lies the answer, we're so used to surviving. I think it's a case of looking forward now, coming away from survival mode and actually, right, okay, what are your goals? What are your aspirations? What are your ambitions? We're so expected to get knocked off our feet every single day.
Yeah.
And we were saying just before, if you watch Sky News for 24 hours on repeat, you're going to feel worse than you did before that 24-hour period. So it's a case of being mindful, developing yourself personally and professionally, up your skill set, boost your confidence, get as much learning and education as you can. Say yes to those speaking opportunities. Say yes to come on podcasts like this and have lovely conversations with people. Actually start to really kind of throw yourself into developing yourself and taking yourself forward, because I don't know about you, but I'm done with survival.
Yeah. I've been surviving my whole damn life. I'm ready to thrive. I'm like, exactly. 40. How old am I? 43.
I feel like we're starting a revolution here. I like this. Come on. I'm 46. I'm 3 years down the line, so it's the grey and the beard.
I hide mine behind here.
That's a good idea. I might get some Just for Men on my face.
So with this, I think that the other point for them, or for anyone who's listening, really, is to accept that we can change and we should change. People seem to want to go back. I know a couple of people, not from the accounting space, I'll admit, but in my personal life, who are stuck in the past. And they just want things to go back to the past because the past was nice, warm and fuzzy in their mind's eye.
Yeah.
And now they don't know where they are. They don't know what they're doing. They don't have a clear future. So they keep going back to the past then and expecting everybody else to be the same. And they don't seem to accept that things move on.
I surround myself with some wonderful people who help deliver my solution-focused stuff with me. And I know Zoe mentions very, very often about, we can never banks back. We can never go back. Very often people just want to go back to how it was before. That just cannot happen. If you look at something like grief, for example, we can never go back to that point before. What you kind of do is you bank forward. You find a new way. It's not the old way, and it's not the best way, potentially.
But it's a new way.
Yeah, which has been massively overused during the pandemic, for sure. But that and the word furlough and pivot was a
which you can't say without thinking about Ross from Friends.
Very true. This is very true. Yeah, shifting the sofa up the stairs. Anyway, you are throwing me off my scent. But I think there's certainly that, for sure. I think it's not about kind of bouncing back. It's about bouncing forward. But so in a spirit of honesty, through 2021, for most of that, I was having counselling and therapy myself. I think it was the sharp end of a very tough time for a lot of people, but especially working in the space that I do. It's quite a heavy environment sometimes, especially I was shielded due to some heart stuff as well, so that didn't help. So I was having therapy, and actually one of the things that I learned from that kind of round of therapy was that actually the one thing that we all need is acceptance.
Yeah.
To fully accept that everything you've ever been through, everything that you've ever done, everything that you ever said has led to exactly where you are today. And the reason why people are stuck is because they can't accept what's gone before, because some of those things have been brutal or painful or harsh or not of their choosing. But once you find acceptance, you build a future based on the principles. What you do next counts.
Mm.
By the way, at Countex in Manchester, I wonder why the audience was laughing. I said, everyone you've ever done has led to where you are right now. There's an element of truth in that as well, to be fair. I still got that outtake somewhere.
You're
as
not wrong.
Yeah, I'm not wrong, exactly.
Oh my gosh, I would blush. So I think it's a very poignant point, and one that I am going to take away with me as well today, because, and I'll date this by saying that today, this morning, I did a post on LinkedIn about my homelessness and how a couple of weeks after GCSEs, I ran away from home, and I spent about a year being entirely lost, like a lost being, a lost soul, sleeping under bridges, homeless shelters, dossing on sofas, all kinds of crazy stuff. It's probably a book in it somewhere.
Absolutely. I've read a lot less of a story than that.
And it's taken me a long time. I started healing from that in my 30s. Took me until my 30s to start healing. And I've come to the point in my healing journey now, just now, where I'm like, that's part of my past. And if I could change it, I probably would, because it's fucking traumatic. But I've come to the part of my life where I'm like, well, it didn't, it happened. And now I can accept it. And the guilt and the shame and all of the horrible ugliness that sticks with you, that's gone. And now I feel more powerful than I ever did, because it's lighter and I can use it for good.
Amazing. I love that. Yeah.
But it's a crazy little journey that we have to go on, isn't it? It's a crazy little journey.
It is. I think we really underestimate the power of our experiences.
Yes.
I think, but also, again, you talk about people feeling stuck. I think we can, and I've seen both sides of this personally, that, and I'm sure you have as well, you can either be defined and owned by your story, or you can actually own and define your story. And there's a real fine line in between. That when I first started doing this full time nearly a decade ago now, and speaking about my experiences, that actually only lasted so long before I started to feel really kind of not in a good place again, because I was being owned by my story. But as a byproduct, like I said, that chaos and the magic thing, the magic and the chaos thing, is that that's how my business was created. I needed to build a business, which wasn't me, and doing something else that wasn't what I was doing. And so these things can come from the worst of times and the worst of experiences. It's an interesting one, actually, because I had a call with a tech founder last week, and he said, I've not had anything bad happen to me in my life. What am I going to talk about? Something bad to do. But it's funny, isn't it? Because they just feel that they haven't been forged or shaped by experience.
Where is my founder story? My origin story.
I went to university and then I started a business and now I'm rich. Okay, that's your story, really.
I tell you what, that's really inspiring to me. I don't know about anyone else.
I much prefer I was born and I was rich. That'd be a lot easier to tell, wouldn't it?
Oh, bless. So there is there's something else I wanted to get to as well, and it's about responsibilities for other people's mental health.
Mm.
So I would say I'm quite empathic, quite a nurturer. I take on a lot of responsibility for other people, and they come to me in like often all throughout my life and tell me their story and like a burden, you know, and I take it and I'm quite good with it. But I've started to realize that actually I don't have responsibility for other people's mental health like I once did. So what's your experience with that?
I would say there's certainly, if you look at people like yourself, people like me, mental health champions, people leaders, influencers, we all get into these kind of spaces because we have this desire to help people. But very often it's fueled by our negative experiences.
Yes.
So therefore, as a default, we feel, I guess, responsible for everybody. Mm. We become that wounded healer. We give and give and give until we drop. And very often you'll be the last person to know this until you get home and switch off and then you're done, just completely frazzled.
Mm.
And I think there's something in that. We need to kind of look after ourselves first to protect ourselves first. I think that's a really important thing to do. And I think one of the things that I try to help people with is to have better conversations around this stuff, is to recognize that as non-solution focused people, as non-medical professionals, as most of us won't be, including myself, but we have big open conversations with people. As you say, people open up with you because you're likable and you've got trust and rapport and you've got that kind of vibe and it's a great thing, but it's also a potential downside for you. So I think it's recognizing, first and foremost, it's not our responsibility to fix people. Is also not a responsibility to hide from people. I think the only responsibility is, it could be the only time in their lives that somebody decides to open up. There is a big responsibility here,
yeah,
but still not to fix them. So therefore, what I try to encourage people to do is to kind of give them an upfront agreement on why you're there. So how this works in my role, for example, I go and deliver a talk at Accountex. Somebody, as they always will come up to me afterwards. I'll say, thank you so much for sharing that with me. Genuinely, I always appreciate it. Mm. But as you know, I'm not a counselor, I'm not a coach, I'm not a medical professional. But I'll listen to you as much as you want to be listened to. I will support you as much as I can. And then I'm going to signpost you to the help that could be really good for you right now. Is that okay with you?
Yeah.
And by asking the question, not only are you safeguarding them and you're safeguarding yourself, but you're also setting the expectation. Again, it comes back to a boundary. I've set an expectation of, this isn't my role to help you in its fullest sense. But that's also why I've got a really good playbook of signposted services behind me, getting to know industry people and all these kind of different things. Then they've got a clear choice. They either say, actually, I'm really struggling, I need help now. We go straight to signposting. Or vast majority of times, and I guess with you for sure, because you have that vibe, is that they just want to be, they just want to talk to you. So I think essentially in life, in a really noisy world, we don't genuinely feel heard anymore.
Yeah.
So they just want to talk to you and be truly heard. And then they're going to feel a lot better anyway.
Yeah.
But if you want to sleep well, if you want to protect yourself, build a playbook of what's available to support people. I have on my website, on the need help section, I've got a whole list of signposted services. None of them are commercially linked. I have no commercial relationship with anybody, but there are people like NHS and Mind and Mental Health UK. But also in your locality, in your area, wherever you are in the world, find out what's available on your doorstep and don't stick to your demographic. So I don't expect everyone I talk to is going to be a middle-aged white guy with a cap on. So I build relationships and communities and walks of life and ways of life that aren't like me. So whether that be gender, sexuality, or race, or whatever. So that means when I have conversations with anybody, I can at least leave them better, leave them better than when I found them.
Yeah.
Which I think is a really good ambition for any interaction in life. If you can leave people feeling better than when you found them, that's a really good place to be.
Yeah. So and then you can walk off knowing that you've played your part and be comfortable with that and be happy and secure in that, rather than just worrying about them.
Yeah, but also recognizing, and the brutal truth is, and we've all experienced this to different degrees, you can give people the best advice, you can signpost them in absolutely the right direction. What they choose to do with that is up to them.
Yeah.
It's the receiver that has the final decision. So very often people will feel guilty if people open up or reach out and something happens. And again, giving advice is so much easier than taking your own advice. And you go through the same kind of checks and measures as well.
Mm.
But the reality is, it's all about the receiver. So all we can do is to do our best. to signpost them in a better direction, but protect ourselves. We know we've done the best we can. I think essentially, though, it comes down to something quite basic and quite human, but I find quite inspirational, actually. It's when people lose hope or the hope of something better, that's when the world gets quite a dark and dangerous place for a lot of people. So if we just say our role is to give people hope or the hope of something better, to signpost them, to leave them better than when we found them, then we know we've done the best we can as the decent, sexy, accountable human beings we are.
Wow. Thanks for tying that one in.
Yeah, you're welcome. Not my first rodeo.
So that leads me to another question that I was I saw something the other day as part of a conversation the other day. Is hope active or passive?
Oh, that's a good question.
Hmm.
Both, I think. Mm. I think you can actively give people hope, but I think if you look at lived experience as an example, and you just sharing what you shared today, you've kind of given me a little bit of an insight I never had before. So I'm starting to think about things differently. I think about you differently. Mm. I think lived experience is the perfect vehicle to drive engagement to help. When you see somebody else speaking about their experiences, it doesn't fix anybody, but it means that actually, if Kelly can do that, I can do this too.
Yeah.
So what you've done is you've unwittingly and potentially without even knowing them, you could deliver a webinar to a sea of blank screens, not knowing who you've impacted, passive hope in that sense, or you could have a one-to-one conversation and you actually really try your best to give people hope. I think I'm going to sit on the fence and I'll splinter and be bomb. But I think
hope for them is the answer to that. I went all out with hope is active, but I'm quite driven in that respect. I think if you've got hope, then something is driving you and pushing you forward. And when you've lost hope, that feels passive to me. That feels like you're just being carried along, taken for the ride. So I didn't have splinters, but I'm very open to, there is so many different interpretations, isn't there?
There is. I think it's the same as happiness. If you look at, I think this could sound more controversial than what it is, but we don't live in a Disney movie. Sorry to break this to anybody. I shouldn't say this at school events, really. I think with the pursuit of happiness potentially is quite damaging. And I think certainly see this, actually I see this in the student generation a lot, that people's expectations driven and fueled by popular media and social media, which is why I'm not on there apart from LinkedIn, is that we expect to be happy all the time. When actually, and if we're not, we feel that there's something wrong with us. And it's... Yeah. But in my experience, people only post for inspiration or desperation, very rarely in between. Mm. So therefore, we're going at the ebb and flow of life. And as you just rightly said, when we're not feeling life right now, we do give away our happiness and our hope, and we go at the ebb and flow of life. And let's face it, it's tough enough to go at the ebb and flow of one person's life, let alone two people's lives, when you put it in the hands of other people. Mm. And you see this play out a lot, that we give away everything that we got to appease other people, to appease other situations and events and conversations. But I guess the reality is, if you're not living a life on your terms, by default, you're living a life on somebody else's terms.
Yeah.
I have thought enough to scare me daily to keep pushing.
Well, that's how what drives me. Like, this is the whole captain of your ship kind of ethos. Mm. Like, you don't have to do everything. You don't have to be everything. You can't be the master of everything. But as long as you're in control, as long as you understand the direction that you want to be heading in, and as long as you've got access to the moving parts, that's all you need. You don't need anything else.
And in a professional sense, I think it's, again, it comes, I did a, funny enough, I've literally, and you can check this out tomorrow, I've scheduled a post about it in the morning. So some of you will know Alex Bond-Burnett, who's a speaking coach in the accountancy space. So on the surface of it, we both do the same thing, but I ain't a presentation skills coach and she doesn't do what I do. So actually what we do is collaboration over competition. Nice. We team up to do stuff because we complement each other. And I think when we take a competitive approach to anything in life or business, all we see is pang signs over our heads. We see moving targets. We don't see the human behind it. But by choosing collaboration, it becomes really powerful. The problem is, to collaborate, you've got to have some key ingredients. The first one is trust. You need to trust people. You can only trust people if there's openness and authenticity and vulnerability for me. That's a big thing for me. But then also being strong enough to communicate your niche. What is it that you do exactly and how do you do it? So that there's no point collaborating with somebody that does something exactly the same as you, because there's just no impact for anybody. So yeah, for me, it's just looking at those kind of things, taking a collaborative approach to everything, I think is a really important thing. For so long, certainly in my professional career, I just lived in fear of everything, a fear of missing out, fear of somebody else getting there first and first before me.
Yeah.
It's just an amazing
taking
thing.
What's yours.
You just get in this huge race. One of my early mentors, a guy called Brad Burton, many, many years ago, about a decade ago now, said to me, there's a reason why race horses wear blinkers. Run your own race, essentially. And he was right. And actually, that's something that always stuck in my head.
It's funny you should mention Brad. So I've known Brad quite a while. I went to his speaker day. I went a one-to-one speaker day with him.
Yeah.
Maybe about 9 years ago, around that time.
Okay.
And he did his speaker day training. So lots of assets to write on and scribble on and do stuff. He's very tactile.
Yeah.
And I couldn't get my story out. He's like, what's your story? What are you telling people? What personal stuff are you bringing in? And I was not in the place, because of my healing journey, I was not in the place to be able to share. And it stuck in my head because I knew that it was in there, but I didn't get it out on that day. It just couldn't come to the surface. So I was like, no, I don't have one. I don't have a story. And it resonates. It rings in my ears still.
It's it's an evolution. Actually, Brad's speaking day was how it kind of launched for me in a bigger way. I had an idea of, hence the reason why that picture up there is Brad and myself at the Now What years ago now.
I've got my little things up here.
There you go. So,
bless him. Twat.
So, so it's all these things that kind of that shape your experience. But when it comes to your story, if you are, there has to be a level of emotional resilience to be able to tell your story. You also have to treat it as an evolution. So the story that I share now is pretty much the full version, but to start with, it wasn't. Because every story has parts and players and situations and sensitivities and stuff. And the exercise I like to set people with, find your voice, is this one. Good homework for everybody here, by the way. If you want to write the story of your life, if you write a 14-side A4 story. 14 sides of A4 is around about 50 minutes, 1 hour keynote. So if you want to write the story of your life, but don't do it from a first-person perspective. I did this. This happened to me. Do it from a third-person perspective, as if Morgan Freeman were narrating your life. How cool would that be, by the way?
Yeah.
And you start to see your experiences in a very different way. It's also a little safer to write about when you're doing it from the third person. Mm. It kind of aligns to something my nan used to say to me growing up, was if everybody dumped their problems in the middle of the room, you'd end up wanting to pick your own back, because you never really know what people are going through.
Mm.
And if you really want to make sense of your experiences and how it shaped you, that's an amazing exercise to do.
Yeah, that is really interesting. I've actually started writing, dare I say it, it sounds really grandiose, but an autobiography.
Nice.
My story. I'm not sure whether I'll ever publish it, but it's a way of me getting it out.
Yeah.
Like, we'll see what happens with it. I've never considered writing it in a third person. I would imagine that would freak me out a little bit. It would give me the heebie-jeebies. I don't know why.
It's strange, isn't it? When you start to throw that kind of narrator. But even if it's just, even if a story goes nowhere, as a personal development exercise, it's an amazingly powerful thing.
Yeah.
To start to see your experiences through the eyes of a narrator.
Yeah. And the other thing, that the reason that I don't know whether it will go anywhere or not, is because I hate whinging. And I don't want my past to be looked at in a whinging kind of, oh my God, woe is you kind of way. Because it wasn't all bad. And there was lots of good stuff as well. But people just pick up on the bad bits, don't they? And I don't want that to happen.
Do they? This is it, you see. See, this is being a healthy kind of devil's advocate here. there's a big element of, well, screw them. It's like being prepared to lose. Actually, some people will get you, some people won't. And I think that's something I battle every week, is that kind of still a little bit of people pleaser in me, or that sensitivity thing of I shouldn't have said that. But actually, people that get you, and people that don't get you, and that's okay.
Yeah.
So it's kind of being prepared to lose. And the assumption that you're creating potentially could be right, but also potentially could be wrong. It's become like Schrodinger's cat in that sense.
It's me being protective. It's me going, don't do that. It's going to be received wrong, probably. Yeah. Right. Well, there's me being, that's it. Right. Pulling this conversation to an end now. Enough about me. all the blinds come down. Shutters come down.
Reverse at the rabbit hole. Yeah.
But I do need to call this show to an end. So there is a final question for you, Nick.
Oh, wow. Yeah, we have been going on a while, haven't we? Yeah, sorry.
The final question for you, and I'm fairly sure you're going to have a lovely answer because you spent a lot of time with them, is what is the sexiest thing about accountants?
Ooh, I think it's kind of certainty. I'm a big person generally. I'm 6'4" and 24 stone. I think it's kind of the certainty element. I think I like trust. And I like knowing what things are, and I like knowing what stuff is. And I like that certainty element. It's just because it's kind of all pretty much the facts and figures of everything. I always find this kind of, because I'm not like that. I find recently when I have my tax return through, both for the company and also for my own stuff, it just feels better when it's all in front of you on a piece of paper. I'm an ex-stationer, so I do prefer paper still. I'm a bit weird like that.
But how antiquated.
I know. Bearing in mind, I used to work for a software company as well. As a whole, let's not go down that rabbit hole. But the point is, I just like the certainty, the trust, and I think it's just it's a way of delivering stuff. Most of the stuff I do on MySpace is very energy, emotion, and the people that I meet are very much like that as well. So actually, when you've got like a calm, considered voice saying, this is it, and this is this, and this is the deadline, and this, okay, thank you.
Here are some facts, figures, deadlines. Here's all the assurance that you need to get the stuff done. Now you can come back down from the clouds, Nick.
If
you're anything like me, that's me. All right, well, it's been an absolute pleasure. If people want to get hold of you, they can go to your website, which I'll link to, and the only other place to get hold of you, actually it's not, they can also get hold of you on LinkedIn, but you've got a podcast of your own as well.
I have the imaginatively titled The Nick Elston Show. Season 8 coming very shortly, featuring you.
Oh, yay!
Breaking news to you.
Well, I
may have brought this out with your team.
I'm delighted to say yes, that would be amazing. So amazing. Let's get that sorted. But for now, I just want to say thank you very much for coming on Accountants Sexy. You've been an absolute pleasure.
Oh, I loved it. Thank you so much. And thanks everyone. Cheers.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that episode. We've got a ton more guests already lined up and I can't wait to share that with you. Please also remember to check out our sponsor Charterpath. They're bridging the gap between financial skills and the non-profit sector. And if you're looking at growing your practice and wondering what is the next step for you or how to do that, maybe you want to check out Accounting Pirates as well. We've got a treasure chest of support there that might be able to help you get to your next level.